Well, most of the material before this talk has been more in the direction of theory than being practical. There have been a few practical things that we've said along the way, and that's going to be remedied, I hope, in this talk. There have to be a few disclaimers because this talk is much less organized and a little bit more scattered than the ones before. And if you haven't been here for the earlier talks, it may be a little bit difficult because I'm going to refer back to, or I'm going to assume, the ideas from the earlier talks so that we can work from them. And again, there has to be the big disclaimer. And that is, even though I'm talking about things for working with desire, it doesn't mean that I am someone that is a paragon of virtue with regard to desire. I have a very strong desire nature, and sometimes it's quite unruly. I've made a lot of progress in my life, but I have a long, long way to go with it. Let's talk about one of the things that's most difficult to work with desire. Desire is extremely subtle. Desire is subtle beyond most of our experiences of this world. Now, some desires, like lust or anger or horror or hate, those are pretty gross and they're pretty obvious. For some people, those are the only emotions they feel. And they get angry just so that they can be feeling something. For many people, including us, we often don't know that we're emoting. And we don't know what our motivations really are. But if we become more discerning, or if we associate with people who are very discerning, such as clairvoyants, it is a fact that we have all kinds of emotions going on all the time. The second part of this is that since we have given ourselves so thoroughly to material existence and sensory pursuit, we literally distract our attention and close ourselves off from recognizing desires. We close ourselves off from clairvoyance or intuition. And with that being the case, we mentioned it last night, the pseudo-ego can operate with immunity, and it can make a fool of us very easily. Psychologists know this. Psychologists and psychiatrists know that there is a great deal of us that is unconscious. And if you look carefully, you can see the effects of it in your life. Most of the time, we don't recognize that those desires are there until we have foolishly fallen for them and made all kinds of horrendous mistakes. A lot of people foolishly labor under the notion or the illusion that their waking consciousness is all there is to be conscious of. That there's this and nothing more. And because of that, a lot of people believe that they are veritable saints or angels or something like that. A lot of people, even among aspirants like ourselves. And if that were true, then why aren't we entrusted from the spirit with higher faculties? Why don't we have these great powers if there is so much of a need in the world? It's because we aren't angels. just takes a few bad thoughts, if you've got power, a few bad thoughts propelled by desire, and you can wipe out people. Now, this also does not mean the opposite extreme. It doesn't mean that we're thoroughly sinful or evil. And it doesn't mean that our waking consciousness is wrong or that it's exclusively lower, because when we are acting with deliberation in full spiritual awareness, we are working with our true spiritual nature, our divinity. All I'm trying to say is that we are partially conscious, and we're only dealing with part of what our being is, both in the good and in the not so good. If our consciousness were so good, why would we manifest such unwholesome fears or anxieties or all kinds of sickly emotions that we have? Why are we afraid of death, for example? It's because we realize that we're not completely pure people. Even if we are aware, as I think everybody in this room is aware, of the inner struggle between the true self and the pseudo-self, we're not completely aware of that. I can't repeat this enough times from enough different points of view, because we need to know this. We're not aware of everything that's going on in us. If we were aware from the advantage of our true higher self, our true nature, we would be godly. We would be able to see ourselves very clearly, and we would be able to see the divinity of the whole cosmos, and we would be awed, and we would be awed into humility, that we would be as gentle as lambs. The more we awaken to that higher consciousness, to our true spiritual selfhood, the more clearly we can see our desire nature, the more clearly we can objectify it or objectify it and see it as though it were external to us, that we can see exactly what our desires and such are. In mystery schools, including the Rosicrucian Mystery School, we're told about the dweller or guardian of the threshold. It is some monster that we have to meet before we can leave our body in full consciousness and, as gods, go into the inner worlds. But the dweller or the guardian of the threshold is exactly that. It's not just some kind of monster or dragon or some kind of elemental entity. It is an objectification of all our unredeemed and unregenerate desire. It's all of our so-called bad destiny that we have not taken care of. As we grow spiritually, as we waken up, we should be able to see our own consciousness, our own manifestations of consciousness. We should be able to see each of our desires just as clearly as if we're on a tower looking at a surrounding landscape. We should know ourselves through and through. We can see very clearly, and we can see very objectively. And when we do that, if we're looking at something like a monster, we can do like we said Leonardo did. If we see that monster sneering, we can see the sneering qualities in our own character. We can see it in our own, you know, like when we sneer and look down on something, and it happens. We all have things, I think, that we sneer at. And we can see it just as clearly as can be. What I'm trying to say is that in the desire world, the form is only representative of the emotion that is behind it, the emotion that has informed it, the desire of something that we want or that something that we don't want. And when we see an objectification of all of those desires before us, we have to look at it very, very carefully so that we can penetrate through to the unwholesome desire that is behind it and know that this is what we do. Even more than that, we have to penetrate behind or through or within that desire and find the principle that it is founded on. Because if we once have that principle, then we can take that facet of our desire expression and turn it into something positive. One does not destroy the dweller or the guardian of the threshold. One transforms it. And the first step of that transformation is seeing what is there and then doing as what we talked about in the structure of the purgatorial activity of the lower desire world, owning up to what we have done. And if we own up to what we have done, we can take that principle and we can use it creatively as an artist or someone else who has some philanthropic notion for the world. This is what we're all trying to do. We're trying to objectively know ourselves. That's what all mystery students have been told to do since the times of Greece. Know thyself. This, of course, to face all of the things of ourselves. Probably all of us that are in this room in some of our past lives have killed people. And we haven't gotten completely well from that yet. So in order to do this, it requires courage. We have to have the courage to face what we have done. Kind of courage that one gets with spiritual conviction. When you care more about serving, when you care more about loving and giving, you have the courage to face whatever the impediment or obstacle is to that service work. And most of those impediments and obstacles are things from our own being. But even more than courage, it requires subtlety. We have to be very careful when we read some of the experiential writings of Max Heindel. He was very careful to keep them at a minimum, but he did say things about what happens to him in the desire world and the kinds of experiences that he had. Because if we're not subtle, and we deal with those kinds of experiences, what happens is we subject ourselves to illusion. And the illusion is that because this phenomena of the spiritual worlds, especially the phenomena of the desire world, because they're so spectacular compared to this world, we begin to believe that we have to become spectacular people and that we have to make spectacular efforts and that we have to, you know, get out our magic wands and do all kinds of great things and be little Max Heindels or something like that. The fact is that we have to become subtle people. Subtlety is by nature very powerful. If we are subtle, and if we can direct all of the subtle forces that are at our command, if we bring them under our command, and if we get inside of our desires and drive them in the same way that we drive a car and go where we want to go with them, spectacular things will happen if they're within our character. We can't ever act outside of character. We are what we are. Maybe eventually our character will evolve to being spectacular, but that's not as important as being in control and driving and directing our desire nature. This is why the pseudo-self is such a formidable adversary, because that pseudo-self is itself very subtle. It has been referred to many times as a subtle serpent. And we've got that kind of thing in us. The irony in all of this is that if we give in to the promptings and urgings of the lower nature, of the pseudo-self, the effect of that indulgence is the opposite of subtlety. The effect of indulgence is hardness. The effect of indulgence is hardness. The effect of even the expression of desire is hardness. This is so even if one indulges in higher desires. If you indulge in making people happy, remember one of the key words in this is indulge, you're going to become hard. This is one of the purposes of desire, to precipitate, to materialize, to harden into being energies and subtle spiritual forces into actions, into the physical world. Because things get finalized in concrete events. Now this is studied very carefully in several places, and it's repeated many times in the writing of Max Heindel. Cosmic conception especially has many examples of this. Max Heindel mentions, and he repeatedly mentions, that the struggle between the desire body and the vital body for control of the physical body is the source of all of our consciousness. Our consciousness in this body, even our spiritual awareness, is due to the struggle between the vital body and the desire body. He goes on to say that, for example, in some periods of our past evolution, when the desire body was dominant and the vital body was not, is when we hardened the bones of our skeleton. The skeleton was precipitated as an activity of desire. And selfish old Saturn or Capricorn rules the skeleton, including the skeleton of death. And all the hardness of our body is due to the same Saturnine effect. When you take a young baby, the bones are almost like rubber. And the older we get, soon even our skin gets cracked from all of the stoniness and the hardness. If we indulge in desire, any kind of desire, hardness will ensue from that. It may be the hardness of aging, or it may be, even worse, psychological hardening. This is a big motivation to me, because personally, I don't want to be a psychologically hard person. Hardness is always going to come out of this. Even the expression of desire in necessity Non-indulgent desire has the effect, but indulgence greatly amplifies it. Now, as we've been saying all along here, the pseudo-self is very sly, it's very cunning, it's very crafty, and it has the stronghold, it has the fortress. It's like somebody being inside of a physical fortress and you can't see, but they just have little holes where they shoot out at you from. Only in this case, it's even, I think, a more difficult fortress, and that is unconsciousness. To some extent, it uses the vital body to its ends. The vital body thrives on regular, rhythmic, cyclic activities. The vital body loves habits, especially good habits, especially pro-life habits. A healthy diet that is kept with eating times being very regular and filled with vital stuff, the vital body loves that. The pseudo-self knows this. And it also knows that if a desire is repeated, that desire is much more likely to be repeated again. The more often we repeat a desire, the more often we are likely to repeat it. This can be both good or bad. For example, this is how all the muscles in our body were built. By repeated actions, trying to do this or go there or something like that. I used to try to play guitar when I was a young man, and sometimes you had to rest and let the muscles and the nerves, which is again that coalescence of the desire body and the lower mind, build so that you could do things that you couldn't do before. So that's a good example of repetition being a positive force. If we experience the thrill and the satisfaction of pleasure from desire, the pseudo-self will want to do it again and again. It revels in desire, and it revels in its own sort of empty egoism with a small e. And so it keeps its supremacy and it strengthens its stronghold. As long as desire is repeated, the more likely it is to be repeated again. The desire body doesn't tire out. It doesn't get cloyed. There's no limit to how much you can desire something. You can desire it again and again, and even with more and more intensity. If we wish to rid ourselves of a desire, we have to cease expressing it, because we're never going to tire it out. Now, all of us, to some extent, this is one of those ironies, all of us, to some extent, are hardened from our desires. In this room, most people are pretty gentle. To some extent, all of us are hardened by desires. The irony that just came to mind is that when we really are softies, when we really do have a soft heart, as our motto says, we're really firm. We're not hard, but we're firm. That came to mind while I was thinking about this. But if we are hardened, the cosmos has three agencies for the softening of that hardening. All three are used in the cosmological processes of our evolution. It's a funny thing. Going into space is not one of them. It's sort of related. When you go into space, at the same time that you get that awe of seeing the whole world before the total globe, you're out in space, and even your bones start to soften because the stony stuff starts I don't know that there's a connection, but going into space is not one of them. One of the agencies is an infusion of life spirit in what we call grace. This is, the effect of this is immediate. It means that the ultimately subtle stuff of the spirit in wisdom and in true spiritual feeling, true spiritual loving, not emotional from the desire world, comes into us and it softens us. The redeeming life spirit is perfect for this because it comes from the part in the spiritual worlds that is beyond selfhood. It's beyond self, so there can be no self-satisfaction. And it has its whole consciousness in redemption and in giving. And when we're filled with that kind of grace, we give to others. And when we give to others, we're more in the higher desire world and less likely to the hardening lower desires. However, this is not really very practical to talk much about, because we can't command ourselves to have the experience of grace. We can make ourselves inviting receptacles for grace, and we can try to draw grace into the lives of others to help them through prayer and other means, but we can't make it happen to ourselves. We can ask, we can't make it happen. The second agency for releasing what we have bound up in desires and which releases the hardness that is a consequence of what we have bound up in desires is unctuous catharsis, such as that which happens in the purgatorial realms after we die, and even to some extent in the heaven worlds after we die. I don't have to repeat, because we've had it repeated so many times, but we as students of the Rosicrucian philosophy try to do this every day by performing the retrospection exercise. And that's a real good example of the subtlety of the pseudo-self. Every time we be, or at least it happens that way with me, it's very hard for me to retrospect, very hard. It seems like everything in my consciousness turns to molasses, and to try to turn everything backwards, it's extremely hard. And then you come to something that's tough to face and that the pseudo-self doesn't want to face, because if you face it, it loses some of its power. And it puts you to sleep right then and there. It's a toughie with that. But even just reviewing the day in reverse order, even without the unctuous, I use a different word than Earl used. I use remorse. What's the word that Earl used this morning instead of remorse? It's contrition. Yes, it's a very good word. I have to start remembering that. I have to look up two words and see what the difference is between the two. I'm a word nut, I guess. But when we see things objectively in the pictures that we have taken in and with our breath record every day, that kind of objectivity is different than the kind of personal subjective memory, and it leads us well on the way to purging ourselves of desire. Unlike grace, this is something we can volitionally do. It's free, and it is freeing. But it takes a good deal of will. Yet we really have to want to do better in order to face this. The third means that the cosmos uses to undo the hardening effect of desire is pain. Pain is the most common cosmological means for reversing desire during the ongoing activities of our life. In fact, it even warns us of our sins. Not all pains are of that nature, that are, they're trying to break down hardening. For example, if we build muscle, when we build muscle, we experience pain. That's sort of an evolutionary pain. It's something that is a building kind of pain. It's still connected with desire since it is in the muscles, but it's not quite in the same way. However, if you build too many muscles, you become hard. People like to say, fuel my muscle tone, how hard it is, right? It's that way exactly. In the Lemurian epoch, when we were a race of teenagers all the time, you might say, we used to visit pain on each other so that we would wake up in the physical world and so that we had the will to withstand conditions in the physical world. We haven't outgrown that need for pain, but now the need for pain is of a different nature. Going back to what we said in earlier talks, pain is a feeling that we feel in the region of feeling in the desire body. It gets our attention, it gets our interest, and it lets us know when our attention or interest haven't been focused on something, when that part of us which we call the lower nature has slyly brought us into a certain type of activity again and again and again, and we haven't paid attention to it. We've been sort of strolling very softly down the garden path, not even knowing it. Pain is also objective. If we accept pain and look for the causes, we grow. Pain can even be very much to our advantage, beside just being cleansed by it. If we feel pain, we can use that as an incentive, and we can drive a very strong prayer if we are feeling pain. It gives us an understanding of how others are suffering, and that is a really strong feeling, and that can be converted like any other feeling into the propelling of prayer. There's a danger in this though, because pain can have the opposite effect. There are people who know that they can thrive on pain and they can use that pain to even indulge in their desires more. We know of this from all those people that do all of those extreme things with sexuality. That's they do that kind of thing. They try to experience desires that are more and more radical through pain. But for us, the pain is positive. Mr. Heindel says several places in the Rosicrucian philosophy, he says, no pains will be spared to help someone who really wants to grow. No pains will be spared. Initiation in what we have to face in it is not a painless thing. It's not necessarily a physical pain. Quite a bit of it is psychological pain and suffering, but it is a pain. Now let's look at another bilateral means for working with desire. This one, however, is not ironic. Cosmographically, the desire body is situated, so to speak, between the vital body and the concrete mind. And if we're trying to work with the desire body and bring it under control, this means that we can utilize the tried and true strategy of both ends against the middle when we work with desire. That is to say that by working with and on the vital body and at the same time working on the mind, we can put a squeeze play on the desire nature and bring it into line. Now last year for summer school, we spent an entire 5 talks on the subject of building the soul body, the 2 higher ethers of the vital body. In that series, we noted that it was necessary to do that to help humanity to take the next step. Because if we don't have the etheric soul body built, we won't have the vehicle of consciousness that is necessary for leaving the physical when the physical dissolves. We can't possibly repeat everything that was said in those talks, but we can repeat a few things that are helpful. Any time that we strengthen the vital body, any part of it, we provide a resilient buffer, because the vital body works in a way very different than the desire body works. And those onslaughts of desire that would certainly break the physical down in a big hurry are made less by the effect of having a strong vital body. So let's look at a few things about it. Our various bodies are called vehicles of consciousness in the Rosicrucian philosophy. Through them, the spirit, which is our true nature, the truth knower, obtains conscious waking experience of the various worlds. To the degree that these vehicles are developed to perfection, and to the degree that we learn how to train them and use them, to that degree, the spirit can be conscious through them. Thus, the more the activities that promote the soul body, the richer our soul bodies will be. And the richer and the thicker our soul bodies, the clearer our consciousness. And since our soul bodies are inwards and only the dense body is outward, being more conscious in the naturally inward perspective gives us a toehold for working on desire, because that is totally inward. And we can begin to get an understanding of the inwardness of the machinations of desire. And we can preserve the physical body so that desire doesn't break it down. The desire body wants to get control of the physical, because in our isolation in the physical body, if the Lucifers can work on us through the desire body, this means that they can get that experience that no one else in the cosmos can get. There's one special thing about the vital body in relation to the desire body that should be mentioned. There are many that could be mentioned, but there's one special one, and that's extremely important. The vital body is the reflective projection of the life spirit. This means that there is a special resonance between the life spirit and the vital body, especially the etheric soul body. This resonance between life spirit is expressed through what astrologers call Uranian intuition, as opposed to Neptunian intuition, which comes through the mind and desire nature. It has to go right through the camp of the enemy, so to speak. The life spirit intuition bypasses the mind and the desire body, and it hits directly on the soul body. Thus, the richer the soul body we have, the more we can have the light spirit intuition, which means the more we can have pure spiritual wisdom functioning in our lives. The life spirit intuition is such that we know something without having to do a bunch of thinking and studying of it. You just know the truth of it wholesale. This is the intuition of the heart. The life spirit has its seat in the heart and in the blood. It is a knowing without having to have all kinds of wheres, whys, and wherefores and explanations. What is extremely important about it is that it gives us, so to speak, a second voice. That is, we have two voices of consciousness available to us when we are in our physical body. If we hear only one view of things or think we have only one alternative, we get very biased and we become resigned. It's very different if we have two contrasting views of a situation and what can be done in it. And another thing about it is that since it bypasses the thought process and the desire process, it's instantaneous. This means that the life spirit intuition gets to the etheric body and our consciousness first. It gets there faster than even the desire nature. So this is that first impulse intuition. And when the second thoughts come, and those second thoughts are usually selfish, the contrast is striking. If we learn to recognize the life spirit intuition, we can act instantaneously. And we can do the right thing before the consideration of desire ever comes in. Now, it's very good that John has been giving these talks on spiritual exercises, because as Rosicrucian students, we are admonished to spend as much time as is right with our lives on inner work. It is our responsibility, it is our duty, and it is the way that we can accomplish things in the service of humanity, in the service of the world, in the service of the cosmos, that are special things that can't be carried out by political means or social means or things like that. This is a very practical admonishment. It takes a long time, a very long time, to become familiar with our inner consciousness. And familiarity is exceedingly important. Even the first step inward is a step closer to the universal spirit. And with that one step, everything feels truer. So if we have two voices within us, which one is which? We don't always distinguish which got there first. The situation is that if we are not familiar with ourselves and if we don't know ourselves, we can't hear the master's voice. We can't hear what is the true intuition. And there's something really interesting about this. In the book of Revelation, Christ, speaking from the life spirit, says, "Behold, I make all things new." This means that every time that we have an intuition from the life spirit, it's completely new. It's unprecedented. We've never had anything like that before. But if we have it a second time, it's possible that that might be a counterfeit from the pseudo-self, because the pseudo-self is very, very cunning, and it can mimic what comes from the life spirit unless we really know ourselves and unless we are listening with our heart for the shepherd's voice. All right, let's take a few minutes and turn to the trance-desire realm. Let's look to the world of thought and the concrete mind, and see the other half of this bilateral strategy. Cosmographically, the concrete mind is antecedent to the desire body. It comes before it in time because it actually is younger than the desire body, but it is more close in spirit to the threefold spirit than the desire body is. Thus, the concrete mind is beyond the desire body. It subtends it. It interpenetrates it. It is more subtle, and it has more power. All of this notwithstanding, the concrete mind is much younger. It's in its first stage. It's in its mineral stage. It's one stage younger than the desire body, which is in its second stage. Because of this subtlety, and because of this infantile state, it's very difficult to get control of the mind, especially since the mind is in the hands of the desire body. The desire body has forged something like an alliance with it. But the good part, everything has a good part and a bad part, I guess, if you want to think of things in that way. The good part of it is because it's so young, it's amenable to change. Something like the physical body, which is very old, if you want to make a change in the physical body, it takes a long time and a lot of effort to make such a change. Using the same quote that John used this afternoon, who among you by taking thought can change his body one cubit? Or was it Earl that used that this morning? That one was Earl. All right. You got one of Earl's and Earl got one of yours. Beside these difficulties that we've just mentioned about the concrete mind, there is one other difficulty, and that is it is in league with the enemy. The concrete mind is part of the pseudo-self, the animal soul that has been reflected into the higher desire body. And it is a very strong coalition that the pseudo-self made when it set up shop. This means that impulses issuing from the desire body are not only exciting and not only urging us to action, but they also have something like reason associated with them. There is enough rationale so that often our desires aren't just a matter of feeling, like I want to feel that. It's like they seem to make sense in a small-minded kind of way. They're convincing. And even afterwards, when we've done something that we know is wrong, if we're not careful, that pseudo-self will have all kinds of rationalization going on. We can rationalize almost any kind of sin that we make. And we've all heard it. We usually put them on the spot, and in rationalization after rationalization comes out, you know, that ego is not going to let itself get beat down, so it comes down with all kinds of responses. The reasons given are sometimes correct. After all, the thought had to at some time come from the spirit. It's just that it gets bent quite a bit. It gets twisted and misdirected. So the question is, how do we use the mind to work with desire? First of all, let's look at how not to use the mind to work with desire. The mind is not a substitute for desire. The seeds of desire are in the region of concrete thought. Everything originates from the spirit comes through the mind. Anything that becomes objectified . It's that same coalescence that we talked about two nights ago of the desire body when it was built. Its origin was in the region of concrete thought. So the seeds of desire are in the mind. But nobody in their right consciousness would ever say that the seeds are a plant. Especially if you see a flower or a fruit, you can't say that the seeds are the plant. The desire world and the desire body matures those seeds, and there is a purpose and a value and a quality of emotion and desire irrespective of any other world, of anything else in any other world. Emotions and feelings and desires are intrinsically valuable in themselves. We are incomplete humans if we don't have emotions, feelings, and desires. However, one cannot solve the problems that we have with distorted emotions or desires with the mind. The problems of the desires cannot be solved by the mind. For that matter, the problems of the mind can't be solved by desires. The problems of the desire body have to be lived out and worked out in the desire body and in the desire world. There is a psychologic, you might say a desire logic. There are already too many people who deny their emotional natures and their evolutionary cripples because of it. We don't want Christian mysticism creating more evolutionary cripples any more than we want to have a stronger pseudo-self with more selfishness. A second thing to not do with regard to the desire body in terms of the mind is that desire is not to be overpowered by the mind. Desire is not to be overpowered by the mind. We can do this. And anyone who's ever worked or studied psychology knows that desires don't die easily. A desire can be ignored for decades, and then it can just spring to life at just the right moment, just as if it had been a second ago. The desires have a very, very long life. After all, it's a divine will that is infused in the desires in the first place. It's a divine life. It's one step closer to the spirit. Now, desires can be starved out or depleted over a long time if we don't express a desire and we don't express a desire and don't express a desire, it eventually gets weaker. But that requires a very long time. A fast of desire would be several lives long before a desire is starved out. What is much better is to transmute desire, to reform it. But we'll come back to that in just a little bit. The attempt to overpower desire has a psychological name. It's called repression. And the consequence of repressing desires is to produce even stronger desires. It gets even worse than that, because the more you repress a desire, the stronger it gets, and when it comes out in forms that you don't recognize. It comes out in new ways. One cannot repress a desire any more than one can repress a nation. And the attempt is very counterproductive. Everything that we've been saying about overcoming or repressing desires can very well be applied to the pseudo-ego. You can't repress that either. You can't wipe it out. It's made of desire, and for that, you know, it's a reflection of selfhood, but it's made of desire. Yes, it has a power that it has taken to itself and has perverted that power, but that doesn't mean you try to obliterate it or to even squelch it. It was the divine hierarchies that helped us to develop it in the first place, and they don't create monstrosities. The word that we're looking for is taming. The best trained horses are the ones that are tamed, not the horses that are broken. If you overpower something and break it, what you have left is something that's worthless, something that could have been of great value. It seems to me that it's a much better idea to make a junior partner of the pseudo-self. An advisor with phenomenal savvy. Right now, we all know it, we have that argument inside, but that argument doesn't have to be a rancorous fighting with ourselves. There's no reason why the lower nature can't ask questions and the higher self give answers. There's no reason why that can't happen at all. But in all of this, that pseudo-self must be tamed. And in the taming of it, we have to be very vigilant. And even saying something like this, we have to be very careful. Because the next thing we might hear tomorrow morning, or maybe even later tonight, is the lower nature might say, "You're breaking me, you're breaking me." It's very subtle. It'll get away with whatever it can. And we might even listen to it in our gullibility. One can only use the mind to direct the desire body and to tame the pseudo-self to the degree that one can control the mind. You can't tame something with something that isn't tamed, something that you can't use. And anybody who's ever tried working with the mind knows that this isn't a small feat either. To hold a thought for even a few seconds requires great will and great determination and great application of will. Thought stuff is more elusive and subtle than desire stuff. And the mind is so young and so distant to our personal existence, it's closer to the spirit, that many people feel they have no power over thinking at all. Many people think thoughts just happen, that you don't think. And the creation of thoughts is not like the creation of a building where you put down bricks and mortar and bricks and mortar. The creation of a thought is born whole. That's the way the spirit works. So that there, if you're not self-knowing, if you don't watch yourself and get to know what goes on inside of you, it does seem like thoughts just happen. We all know from the bumper stickers that other things just happen. And if we're over 50, we know that fat happens too. nothing could be further than the truth. From the nothing could be further from the truth than the idea that thoughts just happen. Many people think that thoughts are cut and dried, but thinking is really an exciting process. If you read the dialogues of Plato, and Socrates in those dialogues says, well, let's follow the argument and see where it goes. And it's like, we're getting on a roller coaster ride here. You follow the whole thought process, and it's exciting because thinking is a creative process. It isn't all just cut and dried. And it's a great way to have a satisfying life. The pseudo-self is aware of all of this, and it uses all of this to its advantage. It just plays dumb and goes along with all of this. Even though the true self, our true being, is capable of omniscience, it has to be waked up. And the truth of the matter is that in the process of thinking, where all of the general will and all the characteristics of the spirit are applied in this very difficult act of thinking, is how that omniscience is waked up. Thinking is a divine process. And not only is the spirit waked up by the process of thinking, it becomes more involved. Remember, the pseudo-self was developed because the spirit was not yet enough involved and not yet enough awakened. And in the process of thinking and gaining control of the mind and getting within all of our vehicles, that is how we become indwelling. So the spirit gets stronger. The general will to live gets stronger. This is why people live longer. It isn't because of the so-called miracles of medicine. It is because life after life, struggle after struggle, the spirit is getting stronger in controlling the mind and bringing all of its vehicles through the experiences. And when that happens, the will to live that drives the archetype, that is the engine of our lives, gets stronger. And so little bit by little bit, we become stronger beings. So when one awakens and learns to take possession of one's vehicles, one can direct the desire body from within. And then one has options. We can move ourselves to do things. This is going to sound like a really simple example, but I like sleeping. And sometimes when I wake up in the morning, I sometimes have a very good morning meditation, but then I want to go back to sleep. And it's one of my forms of indulgence. But I have learned that with the same kind of subtlety that you use in the morning concentration on the verses of John, you can actually say to yourself, you can think to yourself, you can think yourself right out of bed, and you can think the desire body into action. It's a silly example, but it's a perfect example of, in that inward consciousness, you can have the desire body and all of the lower vehicles serving the will of the spirit. Now, we're talking about taming the desire body and controlling it and taming the pseudo-self that lives in the desire body. But in this, there's a very important fact. Everything we have to do has to be consonant with the nature of the desire body. We cannot try to make the desire body be something that it isn't. It was created to an end, and it is the creation is consonant with that end. And if we want to work with the desire body or with desire at all, we have to bear that in mind all the time. And that brings us to some other things, some things that we've mentioned in almost every talk in this series. I think probably we did mention it in every talk. Desire and the desire body is object-oriented. Desire and the desire body is object-oriented. This has been mentioned every time because it is so very extremely important in working with desire. One of the most efficacious methods for wresting control of the desire nature from the pseudo-self, which has become attached to gratifying itself through self-satisfaction in desire, is to change the attention from one object to another object. This is what Rod's talk was all about. If you have something that you desire and you have it in your field of vision, or if you have it in your imagination, as long as you have it in your imagination, the desire body will access that and it will want to go to fulfilling its rapport with that object. The desire is especially strong if we have an inner imagination or fantasy about it. The presence of the object may or may not be there. For example, if one forms a fantasy of sex, the image magnifies the desire and makes it much, much more likely. And anyone knows that if we're trying to satisfy ourselves in pleasure with someone else, that is a repulsive act. And that would be repulsive to any object of our desire unless the other person was having that same kind of fancy and that same kind of repulsive desire. Since it is a fantasy and not an outward objective physical reality, the desire is never satisfied. And in a fantasy world where one lives in fantasy alone without physical fulfillment, one develops a pseudo-insatiability. Some people sell their souls into fantasy. So it's dangerous to form fantasies. Imagination is a power that we use for solving problems and for creating new things. But if we try to arrogate the power of imagination into self-gratifying fantasies, like in the region of wishes, we're using one of the most powerful forces that we have in a very self-destructive way. But for that matter, fantasies are broken by using creative imagination. So if we have a desire attachment to an object, whether there is a fantasy or not, it is usually not successful to relate to that object by negation. If one says to myself, I'm not going to eat that ice cream in the refrigerator, the ice cream is still the object of your intention. And as long as it's the object of your intention, the desire is not weakened in one little bit. But if you have something like a prayer in your consciousness and the subtlety of the pseudo-self starts bringing up pictures of a dish of ice cream, you can, by will, you can be a free person and you can put that prayer and substitute the object for another object. This is an extremely, extremely important thing.
What would be the action?
Yes. Yes, if it were a healing prayer, it would be to focus healing for those who can use it. Or if it were something to just put your attention where you recognize your own personal inadequacies and you pray for the love to be able to not be so inadequate. That's one that I use all the time. No, it's not. It's not overpowering it. The lower nature wants the thrill in pursuing this desire and in satisfying this desire. But if it is taken off of that desire and if from within the attention is redirected to something else, you're not overpowering desire. You're just aiming the desire body at something else, something that's positive, something that's useful. Especially if the desire is of the same root principle. Let's go back to the example that I was trying to use a few seconds ago. Sexual desire, which is the hardest one to work with. If you have an overwhelming sexual desire, we know from astrology that sexual desire is ruled by Scorpio. But so is healing. Therefore, when the lower nature is trying to direct toward selfish sexual satisfaction, if we instead make the object of the desire to focus healing that can redeem something that was screwed up by sexuality in the first place, we're working with the same principle that the other desire worked on, and we're transmuting that selfish sexual desire into a regenerative healing desire, and that can be done because it's the same principle. Oh, I'm probably all lost here. So we can't change the nature of the object of desire, but we can sometimes change the way we orient ourselves. All right, I'm back. Here's where I am. Suppose the object that we desire is something that we cannot do without. Suppose it is food. We can't live without food. We can go a long time, but you can't fast long enough to outlive a desire. You find yourself dead very quickly and having no opportunities to do any kind of service. In such a case, we're not changing the object of desire. Oh, we may change what kind of food. We can change and say, we'll take this kind of food because this is healthier. But we cannot change the desire for food to no food. So what we can do is change our relationship to it. And the nature of the desire world tells us the best way that we can change our relationship to it. When we think food, we think like the dog. We want to pull the food dish to us and we want to growl. Isn't it possible that we can also give to the food? Isn't it possible that we can try to apply the desires from the higher desire world, and instead of taking, that we give, and in that way we transmute the whole desire world? And what I'm trying to say is, I can't say that I'm really, really successful at this, but we've all heard those stories of Christ-like beings, of people who live really holy lives, and they can take situations that they have to deal with, and by giving love to them, that they can change their life and they can change the situation into something positive. The thing itself, they may not be able to change. It's going to be a long time before we don't eat, but we can address the way we deal with something like that. And this brings us to the last practical facet of working with desire for the time being. There are a lot more, but I just tried to pick a few of the most important. If one is looking for the good in a condition or in a circumstance where one would normally be selfish, one is giving. And when you're giving, you're experiencing a different kind of desire than if you're taking. And if one is changing the object of a desire from one thing to another, one is also experiencing new desires. Now, novelty, or having something new, doesn't have to be deluding. It doesn't have to weaken desires. Because if the desires are higher desires, they're not only new, they're more powerful. They are more edifying. And we know that the passion of Christ, the ultimate giving of everything that that being had to give, is much more powerful than anything that we've seen in the world as far as transforming the world. All great beings do that. We are in this evolutionary creation for experience. And variety of experience is a very large part of that. And there's no reason why, in the process of taming desire, that we can't do that by being more fulfilled in our desire nature by feeling all different kinds of desire. Now, in the talk preceding this, we talked about the whole evolutionary creation. That was extremely brief, and it was extremely limited. The grand view of it would probably take many, many books to go through. But it's something like a symphony. You can start out with a few themes, and you can compose a very large and complex symphony. And a symphony, as hard as it is to hear all the parts that are going on at the same time, is child's play compared to the symphony that is the evolutionary creation. The universal spirit is in all of this. It's not vain and it's not wasteful. There is a reason for everything, great and small and varied as it may be. There is a purpose for us being brought through all of these evolutionary conditions. We are awakening our divinity. We are becoming born in the image of God, and God is a spirit, and that spirit has infinitely different, many different sides to it in potential. All of the many and various things around us are parts of the universal spirit. It is spiritually healthy to have variety. This is true even more so in the desire world than in the physical. It is a great joy. It's a holy joy to experience and grow in desire. The arts are excellent ways to escape the drudge of being under the labor of the pseudo-ego. Through painting or music, we can experience new feelings. Especially for the desire world, the exercise of painting, even just putting colors next to each other, is something that awakens new feelings. And it's something healthy. It isn't something really selfish. All of these activities enlarge our scope for life, and we become greater citizens of the universe. We can appreciate more that's going on around us. If we get involved in our petty little world of desire, I know it for a fact that you can get into a very myopic, a very tiny world where you're fixated on desire or not satisfying a given desire, and that's not a very big world at all. The personal ego, which is another name for the pseudo-self, the true ego is impersonal, the true self, is that it's personal. It thrives on a personal context. You said that to me, that kind of thing. You want to get in a huff and wants to take everything personally because it's the king. Hard to be personal about the wonders of nature. It's hard to be personal about the beauties of art. Some things astonish you and put you in awe in such a way that even colors that you never liked before become wondrously positive things to you. Of course, in talking about things like this, the question always comes up, then why are so many painters such egotists? And I can see two potential reasons for that. The fact is that they may be more engrossed in their process and in what they are doing. I have run into many of the egoistic artists that think they are magicians because with little daubs of paint they can create an entire world. But it goes along with that statement from William Blake that we used when we looked at the horoscope of William Blake. If a fool persists in his folly, he will become wise. And probably another reason is because when we start working with arts or things like that, it's a threat to the pseudo-self. And the more that the pseudo-self is in threat, the more it comes out like gangbusters to really do its thing. And the sign of egoism in artists is a sign that there is a threat to that petty personal ego and that they really are making progress. In any case, egoism is not necessary to art, and you can have a great time with it in yourself and in appreciating it. And at this point, I just quit taking notes because it was too long. And let's just close with an idea, and that idea is what we're trying to do in art or in looking for the good or giving in places where there are things that we have to do. And we can do them by giving rather than by taking from them. The whole life of giving is what we aspire to. Christ Jesus said to us, it is more blessed to give than to receive. And from the perspective of the desire world, this is a spiritual fact. Christ Jesus said to us, greater love hath no man than he lay down his life his friends. That is an ultimate kind of giving. So let's just close with the Rosicrucian student's prayer. O God, increase our love for thee so that we may serve thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength. Thank you very much. It's been really a nice summer school.